PSYOPs comes in and looks at his mission and looks how they can support his mission with a campaign of informing the target audience. The classic one was the first Gulf War, where we produced millions of these safe conduct passes that they dropped out of aircraft on Iraqi positions. At 14 and three quarters, you could go and apply to join the army. We did a Northern Ireland tour in 77. We had shootings, we had a couple of rocket attacks, loads of riots, a few IEDs, and this guy being the captain, beaten up and left dead in the middle of the road. And that sort of haunts me a little bit. So I did about 2 years as a teleop radio relay operator. This new unit was forming called 15 UK Psychological Operations Group. So I became a purveyor of propaganda, lies and deception.
This is a strategic asset. It's up there with SF-type operations. This is game-changing stuff.
It was a successful operation because we took in more weapons than we set out to do. I loved it.
Welcome to the Debrief Podcast, where this week I have Tim Heal, 44 years service, under the colour, as he calls it. How are you, buddy? You all right?
I'm good, thanks, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming. So I'm going to do what I do to all my guests. I'm going to crack into your childhood, and then we'll see where it takes us.
Cool, blimey.
Childhood. Right, yeah, where were you? Where were you as a child?
I was lucky to survive childhood, actually.
Yeah, go on.
I was born and dragged up in Hatfield, but I was actually born at the back of the Havelands.
Hatfield, that's up north, isn't it?
No, Hertfordshire.
Hertfordshire, there you go, that's how much I know. There you go, Hertfordshire. That's
so, posh, I mean, you obviously heard of the Havelands.
Yeah, of course.
Used to make the Comet and all that. Well, during the. I was born just at the back end of it.
What year was you born?
1958.
58?
Yeah, so I'm sort of cracking on a bit.
You are, yeah. I didn't like to say anything like that.
But it was like two cottages and a farm, a place called Simon's Hyde.
Okay.
And we were there for a few months before we moved into Wellham Green. And then we moved into Hatfield.
Okay.
And Hatfield at the time was a pretty rough place. It was the overspill from people moving out of London, East London, North London. And it was pretty rough.
I've heard for it for some reason. I can't think why. That's why I thought it was something like, did you have some politicians come from that way or something like that? I don't know.
Well, the only famous person I know from Hatfield's me.
Right, so what was you like at school?
School, I'll tell you a little story about my school. I was in junior school.
Yeah.
And I got picked on by a bully. We had a bully in the class, and he came around and picking on me. I asked the old man what I should do about it. He said, son, the best thing to do as a bully is give him a good thump and expect an hiding. So anyway, next day, goes into school, he starts. All anybody saw was me thumping him, him flying back into the school pond. I get dragged off by the ear to the headmaster's office and I got six of the best.
Yeah, you did, didn't you? Because I got caned in my day, so you must have got double caned in your day.
Oh, Jesus. And that put me off schooling.
It's not everyone's game, is it? I didn't like school at all, hated it. But was your parents stable? Did you have a stable background, mum and dad?
Not really.
Okay.
Parents broke up when I was about nine.
Okay.
We moved down to New Haven.
Yeah.
Or Peacehaven, actually, for a few months when my mum left me dad. And I went to school at Telscombe School. And down there I did the 11 plus.
Okay.
And I failed that miserably. and then I wanted to be a farmer up to the age of about 10. I really wanted to be a farmer.
Okay.
And following my uncle's footsteps and go to Haddam Hall.
Okay, what kind of farm is that? Is it animals or?
My granddad worked on a pig farm.
Oh, okay.
So I used to go down there a lot working with the pigs and really enjoyed it. So after I failed the 11 plus, got the opportunity to go and have a look at Haddam Hall, at Much Haddam. It used to be an agricultural boarding school.
Okay.
So I took the entrance test for that and failed that miserably. My life changed then, so I thought I'll join the army instead.
What? That's quite a swing fire from being pigs, army.
Well,
what was your thinking? What was your rationality? And how did you know about the army?
Well, Saturday morning pictures mainly. Oh, you said I loved the old war films, particularly the escape films. Like, I mean, we had out the Wooden Horse. The Great Escape came out.
Yeah.
So we used to sort of see those sort of films.
People wouldn't know about the Saturday morning type stuff now, would they?
Saturday morning pictures. Kids don't know they're born nowadays.
No.
I mean, Saturday morning pictures used to be a right giggle. Used to get half a crown pocket money, and on the way, pick up with my mates. One of us would spend sort of two bob on a packet of fags and going down a back alley smoking, thinking real big lads like. Get to the pictures. One of us would go in, pay his tanner, a sixpence, and go and open
it. Let the others in with the fire escape.
Yeah. I mean, he got two or 300 kids screaming. You can't really enjoy the film as much, but yeah, it was, Saturday morning pictures was a giggle.
Yeah, great. So that was sort of like your inspiration then of joining the army.
Yeah. But in the meantime, when I moved up to secondary school, I was too young to go and join the army cadets.
Okay.
So I ended up joining the sea cadets as seaweed. Okay.
So
I did about 18 months as a seaweed before I was old enough to go across to the army cadets.
Okay.
And I learned a love of sort of sailing and messing around with boats in the sea cadets. And then the army cadets kind of put me in a really good stead for joining the army.
I as you know, was an ambassador for the army cadets for quite some time. And it does nothing but good, to be honest, for me.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? It's a great foundation. And if you are thinking about the forces later on in life, well, you know, what a great place to start.
Absolutely. So the when I joined the army cadets, been in there for a couple of years, at 14 and three quarters, you could go and apply to join the army. So I did. So I went over to St Albans.
14 and three quarters.
14 and three quarters, yeah. So I went across to St Albans to do the entrance test. And funny thing, I failed that miserably too.
You do all right on these tests, don't you?
I did, yeah. I mean, pressure. It's pressure. And the recruiting sergeant, he says to me, son, if you can't learn to read and write proper, you ain't going to be able to get in the army. I suggest you go and have a word with yourself and come back after you've done a bit of learning. Oh, Christ. So that weekend I went home. I went in a real dark place, had a real strong talking to myself.
Yeah.
Went back into school on a Monday morning and I went to every single class. Half of the teachers thought I was a new student. I used to bunk off all the time.
Who's this geezer?
I know. So we used to go in the morning, get registered and then piss off.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
So I started knuckling down and for about 6 months I really worked hard. I mean, I did all the homework. I really worked hard. And went back about 6 months later with a mate and walked in the recruiting office, recruiting sergeant said, I'll remember you. Have you done so much? I said, I have. So he sat us down in this room, gave us a test each. He said, I've just got to pop out and do something quick. So get on with the test, lads. Anyway, filled it out. My mate was giving us some of the answers. And I managed to scrape through. And then we went down to, I think it was Cosham, which was the recruiting, pre-recruiting.
So what year was this?
This was in 73.
Wow.
So late 73.
Yeah.
And managed to scrape in and got a place as a junior soldier at a depot of the Queen's Division, Bassingbourne Barracks in Royston.
Yeah, my son's just been up there. So it's not that anymore. But
as a Royal Anglian.
Yeah, wow.
So...
So extremely proud of that, really, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I to tell you the truth, I did mug school off a bit after that.
Mate, I mugged it off all my life.
But I got a place.
Yeah.
And from there, on the 5th of August 1974, I turned up at the depot of the Queen's Division and started the training. Now, we started with three big platoons. There was, I don't know, close on sort of 200 or 300 kids.
Really?
It was a big intake. And, when we finally passed out, there was 25 of us left in our platoon.
Really? So that's quite high attrition, isn't it?
It was high attrition.
I don't think it's that as bad as that now, because obviously they try and filter out most of it before it gets here, don't they? Do you know what I mean?
They nurture you a little bit more now.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I've been up to the Junior Soldiers Academy. Right, it's an impressive place.
The one up at Harrogate's particularly. Right. I mean, it's really good.
Really good to see what they're doing up there. Like,
my son went through there.
My stepson went through there. So
it's really, really good.
Yeah. So how did you find training? I mean, my training, I loved it. Were you the same?
I'd been through the Sea Cadets and the Army Cadets. I had a good idea of what's coming.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It was brutal. Don't get me wrong. It was tough. I mean,
especially for what were you, 16 years old?
Yeah, 16.
That's what I'm saying. 16 years old. That's a shock to your system.
It wasn't so much because I'd been away an awful lot. I mean, I was never a home boy.
No.
I was never a mummy's boy. but from that point of view, I really enjoyed the training. And we did our 24 weeks, and then we went over to the adult training and did the last 12 weeks of the adult. We joined them at the...
So where were they? Where was the adult training?
That was at the depot as well.
Oh, okay, so it was all at Bassingbourne.
Yeah, so it was all at Bassingbourne. Oh, okay, we had junior soldiers there and sort of adult soldiers. Okay. So went through training, passed out training, and I got posted to the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Anglian Regiment, the poachers.
The poachers, there you go.
Once a poacher, always a poacher.
They've got poachers, Vikings, what else they got?
And there used to be Pompadours.
Pompadours, that's the one. Yes.
But the Pompadours got disbanded in 1994 and got swallowed up with the other two battalions. And then the reserve battalions sort of went across to what they called the East of England Regiment. And then somebody saw sense and renamed it Royal Anglians. And they became the 3rd Battalion, which is now the Steelbacks.
Right, okay.
And they're really well recruited and really well thought of soldiers.
No, great unit. So where did you go as a
first posting?
Poacher.
Munster in Germany.
There you go, a drinking posting.
Oh, Jesus Christ, yeah. that was a culture shock.
Yeah.
It was a drinking culture back then. And, I was there we got there in September of 75. We came out in June 76. We came back to Gillingham in Kent.
Okay, yeah.
And although we had a 2-year posting in Gillingham, I think we spent about 6 months there.
Really?
So we was always away on exercises. We did a Northern Ireland tour in 77.
That must have been punchy. Was it punchy?
Was it ever?
Come on, tell us a little bit about Northern Ireland 77, because that's before my time.
Well, A Company were posted to the Ballymurphy.
Okay.
And the Ballymurphy at the time was really hot. We had some sort of major incident pretty much most every day. We had shootings. We had a couple of rocket attacks.
Yeah.
One of the rocket attacks was really funny because we used to have two Saracens and the post office van used to come in to go up to what we call Kelly's Corner, which was the White Rock Road and Springfield Road, and the post office there. So I had to be escorted in. And this RPG was fired from the bull ring. Missed the post office van, hit the wall of this house. The wall of this house fell in, and a bloke was in bed and landed on the front garden. Like,
cheers for that.
Yeah, that was ever so funny. But we had loads of riots. We had a few IEDs. I was
because that was still like after that honeymoon period that they experienced. This was when it really. That's when they touched the paper, wasn't it? It really went for it, wasn't it?
It was. It was
a lot of civil unrest. Lots of civil unrest, wasn't there?
Lots and lots of civil unrest. We had, I mean, a riot kick off like that instantaneously.
They're scary things, right? So I did one in London there years ago, and it's like on that baseline, you are like,
yeah.
Especially once the old petrol bombs start coming in. It's...
Well, I was on a batten gun.
Nice. That's what you want is the batten gun.
So, so we've got this football match. Everybody's in the cookhouse watching football. Unbeknownst to us, there was a riot outside and they were stoning the camp. But it must have, one of the rocks must have cut the wire from the ops room to the cookhouse because nobody saw anything out. Till somebody came in and shouted, "We've been attacked, crash out." So we grabbed their kit, grabbed my batten gun, and we went out the back of the Moyard entrance, which is the back entrance, and we came round the side. And all these Herberts are throwing rocks into the camp and everything. And all we saw, as we came down, we got the order to fire. But we had a problem. Normally you have to fire 25 grain at these buggers. And these are only they just catch. We run out of those.
So you had the old...
So we had the white brick ones, the 45 grain.
Yeah, 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 the 45 grains.
So as we've come down, they've seen us and started to run away. I've got the order to fire, so I've fired this thing. And it's bounced off the ground and he's got this lad right in the back of the leg. And as he's running away, his legs have overtaken him. He's landed on his swede. The snatch boys have gone out and grabbed the leg apiece and they're running back with him and he's flailing about. His head's banging, his arms are flailing about. All the back end of his head split open anyway. They nicked him. But that was one of the incidents that was really funny. Cause
busy old time then.
You just see the round. And it was like slow motion.
Good shot. Once it's hit the floor, it can go anywhere as well. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a bit of luck involved in that one.
Yeah, so that was a pretty rough tour. We were shot at once. We're going out in sort of four-man bricks as a 12-man patrol. We came down out of the Moyard down into Spring Hill Avenue. And when we were in training, we used to change sides. And it just changed and we swapped sides. 2 months we've been out there. I'd always been on the front right. Guy called Alan, who's a section commander, was on the front left. I had a guy called Terry behind me and Chris behind him. As we're coming down Spring Hill Avenue, we'd only just come round the corner. He said, change. What? So we swapped sides. We got about 100 metres down. Two rounds from not an Armalite, the other one.
8K-47?
No, a smaller one than that.
That stubby thing that they used to.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've
shaved that because I fired two rounds back. Yeah. The first round must have whizzed past his head because he dropped the weapon. The second one went through a stained glass window of Corpus Christi Church.
He got away then, I'll take it.
He got away, but we retrieved the weapon afterwards. But he got Alan in the groin and went out for his backside. Now he sent a contact report. Hello, one. This is 13 Bravo. Contact, Spring Hill Avenue. Send Starlight. I've been shot in the arse. Out. So I've seen him go to ground. He fell over.
Yeah.
And we thought he'd been shot in the arse. So we're doing a follow-up behind us till we realised that it wasn't. I mean, the exit hole was small, just the entrance. So it just clean gone through. But we did the rest of the team came in, ambulance came in, he went off, and we carried on with the cordon and everything.
Put a cordon up, no doubt, sat on it for many, many an hour.
We did.
I used to hate cordons. Those are horrendous, weren't they? Get that. Once that white mind tape goes up, you know you're in for a day, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then a couple of weeks later, we got crashed out. We were on QRF. We got crashed out to Kelly's Corner. There was a bit of a ruck going on up there. So we went up there, and as we arrived, they started throwing stones at us. So we made our way around the back of this house, and as we were going over the fence, my mate Paddy was in front of me, and they command-detted a what's name? He caught most of it. I got blown over and landed on me head, got a big lump on me head.
Yeah.
They dragged him off to hospital. I was out on the ground for another 6 hours. With concussion.
With your helmet bouncing off you.
Oh, we didn't wear helmets. We weren't wearing helmets at the time. We had a choice when we went out whether we were on flak jackets or not.
Yeah.
Depends on what sort of patrol we were doing, whether we wore them or not, because we could move around a lot quicker without them on.
Yeah,
so we got blown up. That was a rough tour.
Yeah, sounded it, yeah. Did you lose anyone? Did the battalion lose anyone out there?
We didn't actually lose our blokes, but we had other blokes come into our area to help us out, and we've lost about four guys from the Royal Scots.
Wow, yeah, sad times as well.
Yeah,
so that's your sort of like baptism, that's your welcome to the real world, isn't it?
Yeah, you know what I mean? And I saw my first dead body back then.
Yeah.
That was a rough time.
Who was that?
Just some Irish guy up in the, we had a Protestant area just next to the Ballymurphy. And this guy was in been knee capped and beaten up and left dead in the middle of the road.
Really? Done a number on him then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's a bit of a. How old were you then?
19.
Okay, so yeah. It's a lot to be taken on board, isn't it? But you do grow up, don't you? You have to grow up.
I had my 19th birthday out there.
Yeah. I think I had my 19th in Londonderry, do you know what I mean? It was like, there were so many tours of Ireland in those days, wasn't it? You were always out there, weren't you?
Well, at the end of Gillingham, I mean, we've been to Italy, we've been to Gibraltar.
Yeah.
Gibraltar was brilliant. I got pinged to do the convent guard and the Four Corners guard. And that was great fun. And the convent guard is the governor's house.
Yeah.
And the guard room's the other side of the road, and you've got to march across the road and march up and down. And the guys that's not on stag are trying to make the person that's on stag laugh for the tourist light. And then the Four Corners guard, because that time the border was closed with Spain.
Okay.
So that was a cracking tour.
Yeah, but that was fun. It's a good night out over there, isn't it?
Well, when we flew in, we flew in on a Herc, and we come from a cold UK, and we're all wearing sort of long johns and woolly pullies and all the rest of it. And as we sort of landed and the back doors of the Herc opened up, you could see this haze.
Yeah, yeah.
And it came to our, we had to march off, and by the time we got across to the the terminal, half of the boats were sort of collapsing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a funny.
So, what was your sort of like? What was your rank at this stage? What rank?
Oh, I was Bakshi Private.
Okay.
Yeah, I was.
How long was you a Tom for?
I didn't pick up until I got to Berlin.
Okay. So how long you been in then?
Well, we went after Gillingham. We went to Berlin. That was in 78.
Oh, okay.
So 78 to 80, we were in Berlin. What a fantastic post.
Did you do the old looking after the prison and all that sort of stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, did Spandau, did flag tours across into East Berlin. They were great fun. You had to wear number 2 dress.
That's right, but you could go and have a few scoops, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Cheap as
chips.
Well,
we used to go over in the evening for that.
Yeah.
But on the flag tours, we had a big Opel Imperial, like limousine. And we used to go through Checkpoint Charlie. And as you get into East Berlin, you pick up a tail, whether it's East German or Russian,
yeah,
and they'd follow you around all day until you came back out again. And there's a few places you had to visit.
Yeah.
So that was good fun. The British military train was probably one of the best duties that you had in Berlin. It was an early start. You get to Charlottenburg about 6 o'clock in the morning, and the train sort of leaves, and it's like a Pullman class.
Okay.
And you have a posh breakfast on there and all the rest of it, just showing off in front of the East Germans. So you go through Helmstedt and Potsdam.
And how long are you on that for? You're on it all day?
Yeah, it's all day. You get back in the evening.
Oh, okay. What's the point in you being on it?
Well, it's just to prove that we could go through East Germany, basically.
Right, okay. It's a bit of a jolly, really, then.
Oh, absolute jolly.
We like a jolly.
Yeah. So that was a cracking.
Was that a couple of years out there?
We did. I did 2.5 years in all.
Wow.
So really enjoyed Berlin. Berlin back then was awesome. Was the best posting ever.
Yeah, I heard, you know, the Royal Hampshires went out there about 5 years prior to me joining.
Yeah.
And everyone said you'd missed out there, like, do you know what I mean? Because they had a great time out there as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, sounded like fun. So after that, where did you do? Had you progressed through the ranks a little bit by then?
Well, I picked up my last jack then.
Okay.
And the powers that be deemed it the right thing to do after having a plum posting like that to send us to Londonderry for 2 years.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
So get yourself in the bog side.
Yeah. So bog side of Craigan. It's no fun whatsoever. Strabane.
Were the Rossville flats still there when you was there? Were the flats still up? Yeah, they were just taking them down the first time I went there, but it's sort of like, you could tell, you know, all down that you know, Rossville Street.
It was a horrible place. I hated it. So the back end of that tour, it was October 82.
Yeah.
The company commander called me in and said, did I want a posting? Okay. Yeah, where to? He said, you're going to Sennybridge to the Army Hang Gliding Centre. Okay, what's hang gliding?
I'll have some of that.
So anyway, that October, just before we pulled out, I got posted to the Army Hang Gliding Centre at Sandy Bridge Camp. And I did 3 years hang gliding.
3 years hang gliding? That's just like, wow. Yeah, I mean, nothing like that ever happened to me, I'm going to tell you.
I didn't even know what it was when I arrived. And, and day one, this guy, Captain Taggart, had set this thing up.
Yeah.
He was a Remy officer. He died a couple of years after, while I was there. And was actually flying one night when he parted company for his man glider. Died in front of us. Yeah, it was horrendous.
What did he do, fall off it?
Yeah, basically what he'd done, he was testing somebody's glider for him. So he clipped in with his harness and he was too low. So he clipped in above the hang loop. And I'd taken off beforehand and I'm flying up and down. It was Hay Bluff. I was beating up and down the ridge.
Yeah.
Lovely evening flight. And he took off and we were sort of doing wing overs together. At each end of this ridge, and he came over one and it stripped the hang loop that he was on, and he fell about 200 metres, bounced off rock.
Did you see him go?
Yeah. So I landed as quick as I could.
Down as quick as you could and go.
And there was two other students there as well that were up there with us that evening. There's nothing we could do for him. Yeah, that was a sad moment.
Yeah, I bet, yeah. And the thing is, as well, on a sort of like adventure training trip, you don't expect it to end like that, do you? Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like there's an atmosphere around these places which is not. If you're in Londonderry, you
expect something like that, but not on adventurous training.
On a sort of like great day out, everyone's having fun, and then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, that's minging.
I mean, paras were probably the worst. There's something not right in the head. because they go for a whole training period to learn how to fly. So you start on flat ground and then you work slowly up. And you get the final test to get your Pilot 1 certificate is that you have to take off from about 900 feet, fly out, stall the aircraft and recover it.
Yeah.
Put some turns in and land. this one guy who's a para, he took off and immediately went into a stall, crashed on the side of the hill. Just bounced. Didn't do the hang glider a lot of good.
No, so 3 years there, that must have been quite a good 3 years.
Yeah,
other than the obvious incident, but
yeah, I really enjoyed my time in there.
What's it like going back to your unit after you've been somewhere like that?
Well, this is where it came to a head. I was remarried at the time, was divorced and going to get married again. The current one at the time didn't want to go to Germany because the battalion was in Colchester at the time and they were earmarked to go to Celle.
Okay.
And they were going to be in Celle for at least 5 years.
Another drinking tour.
Yeah. She didn't want to go. I'd come into my 9-year man service, so I did sort of 18 months as a boy.
You do something for the Queen, don't you? The King now, but you do it for the Queen, don't you?
So nine. I got to my 9-year point, and she didn't want to go. I didn't want to leave her behind, so I put my papers in. But while I was at the hang gliding centre, I used to live on camp.
Okay.
And we used to live in a little cookhouse there. And Buddy Yoropos, what's his name? Andy went there.
Yeah.
He came through with a couple of his mates and they were scoffing in our cookhouse pre-selection. So I met him and learnt a little bit about, I mean, after 82, everybody wanted to join the SAS.
Yeah.
So on the weekends or days that it wasn't flyable, I used to stick a bag on my back and have a wander around the hills. So I had the idea when I got out, I'd go and apply to join 21SAS.
Okay, yeah, cool.
Now that's a funny little story. So I turns up down at Duke of York headquarters with about 100 odd other blokes. We're all in this big hall, and there's this little jock horror Sam there. He said, "Lads, listen up." So the whole place went quiet. It was fairly quiet anyway, because I mean, they were all sort of cagey.
Yeah.
And he said, "I've got some advice for you boys." This is in his jock accent. I can't do that.
No, yeah. Swerve it if possible, or it comes out really bad, I'm going to say.
he says, "Lads, all those that you that smoke, put your hands up." First, put your hands up. "All the yous that don't take sugar, put your hands up." He said, "Right, those that smoke, give up. Those that don't take sugar, start." And that was it. And then we got split down into sort of, I think, three different groups.
Yeah.
One group went out, run around the track. That was a laugh.
So he's a civvy now. You'd got out and now you were applying for 2-1.
I'd literally just got out and just about to get out because I applied before I got out while I was on terminal leave. So I was up there and we were running around the track. You had to do 12 times around the track to do the mile and a half, like.
Yeah.
And you had to do it in under 10 minutes. So clever bugger here. Got round at about 8.5 minutes, 9 minutes. He said, "Go round again." Doing about 3 extra laps. And then we went in, done some paperwork, and then we went in to see the doctor and all the rest of it. And then they told you, go and report to whichever squadron you was going to. And I was at C squadron over at Hitchin.
Okay.
So it turns up at Hitchin on the drill nights. And I did that for, well, about 8 months.
Okay.
And then I broke. I smashed up my knee. And that was the end of SAS career, really.
Yeah, so you wasn't...
Time I got the injury sorted out. Life had moved on. And I got transferred over to regular reserve.
Okay.
Which was, you turn up once a year with your kit, watch a video or something.
That's right. Yeah. It just kept you in sort of like
give you 100 quid plus your travelling expenses.
That's right. Yeah.
Thought, that's all right. So I did that.
What were you doing for work now?
I started off as a motorbike courier.
Okay.
And decided it wasn't a great future in it. So I went lorry driving.
Okay.
So I did a bit of lorry driving.
Long distance type stuff.
I ended up doing continental work.
Yeah, nice. I'd always fancied that. That would have been my route if I hadn't gone, obviously, the route I did. That would have been, I think I'd have headed for that because that's...
Well, I got on...
Get your cab, don't you? Set it out of your light, disappear, nobody telling you what to do all day.
That's
make
it.
Make your timelines, dump your gear off, pick some more
well,
up.
Well, it was good back then because mobile phones hadn't been invented.
That's right, yeah. You got a big old wad of dough, didn't you, in your big old purse on a chain in your pocket.
That's the... you've seen them, haven't you? Your clogs on.
That's right, yeah.
Well, I worked for a company called Stringer Transport out of Ampthill.
Right, okay.
And he put us into Samson Transport, which is a Danish company. And I did a lot of Sweden. I did a lot of Europe, a lot of Portugal, Spain, a little bit of Italy. So I did a lot of work for them over about 3-4 years. And then I made the error of going to work for a Norwegian. I got a job working out of Moss in Norway.
Okay.
And on a line truck. And the line trucks go from Oslo, and we were doing Paris. And there was about 4 different companies that we worked for. It was Danzas, Kalbersons, Schenker. So... we were working with wagon and drags. So we'd load up in Oslo, catch the ferry across into Denmark, drive almost non-stop down to Paris, stick the truck on one bay and the hangar on the other bay, stick your papers in, get your head down for 11 hours or 10 hours, they come and knock you up, hook up, drive all the way back again. And if you got it right, you was on a grand a week for a trip, or grand a trip.
Yeah, that's all right, isn't it?
If you worked it right, you could get 2 trips in a week, sort of $2,000 a week. This is back in 1990.
Yeah, that's proper dough, isn't it? That's good.
That
old,
was really good,
old
money back then. But I was drinking about 3 litres of filter coffee and smoking about 60 to 80 fags a day.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Just to keep us alive, just to keep us going. And I came back in I think it was June for a break, and I never went back.
No.
And I gave up smoking. I was ill.
Yeah.
Scratched
yeah.
that. But all the while, I was still on regular reserve, so I used to turn up.
Yeah, obviously, when did you decide you were going to come back into the fold? Because did you join up again?
I did, yeah.
So you failed Civvy Street, basically.
Yeah. I struggle with civics. I really, really struggled.
You won't be the only one who ever says that in this room, I'm going to tell you.
We're just civvy work mentality.
Johnny's cringing over there because he's a civvy through and through, but yeah. He struggles with me as much as I struggle with him.
So I've been on this regular reserve for about 3 years, and they sent us a letter. Did I want to sign on for another four? I thought, turn up once a year, get 100 quid just for... Nothing, really.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, sent that back. And they sent me mobilisation papers.
Yeah.
Yeah, report to the depot of the Queen's Division for 2 weeks star training. I thought, yeah, that'll be all right. Turn up at the depot in the naffy every night with a few jars. Nothing like it. We turned up there. It was like a mobilisation package. They took all our civvies off us, upscaled our kit. Stuck us on the back of four tonners off to Stanford.
Wow.
2 weeks converting to the new respirators, the new SA-80.
SA-80 you'd have had, yeah.
And all the latest techniques that they were using back then. So 2 weeks there, we didn't get a chance to have a much of a drink at all.
Devastated.
Anyway, so then I was working for an agency at the time, and they put me into, there wasn't a lot of driving work going on, so they put us into a call centre for BT.
Okay.
And one of the guys there I was working with was a staff sergeant in the signals over in Bedford. So he said, "Boy, don't you come and join us lot?" So, and I said, well, I was 37 at the time. Wow. No, they just changed the rules, he says. So, went over there, got into the TA, took a little bit of time.
Yeah.
So I did about 2 years as a teleop radio relay operator.
Okay.
On Euromux. Had a really good time. And then this new unit was forming, Chicksands, called 15 UK Psychological Operations Group. And I got invited along there to have an interview. So I went along, and because I've got a bit of a background in printing,
yeah.
My wife at the time worked at a printer's, and I used to go and help out when they had big jobs on minding a single colour press. So I got a good idea of the print process and all the rest of it. So that was one of the requisites. Plus I could drive a wagon because I had some wagons there, and got invited to join the group. Transferred across to 15 site.
So tell me a little bit about what the job was going to entail there.
Well, initially I was employed as a driver on the print section.
Okay.
So
printing what was being printed?
Well, leaflets mainly. So when I joined, you have to, everybody that joins the unit goes on the course.
Okay.
It was the military psychological operations course.
Tell me a little bit about that, because it's a world I know nothing of. So you're sort of like you're teaching me today.
So I became a purveyor of propaganda, lies and deception.
It's a bit of me, that I'm going to tell you.
So
the leaflets, these are leaflets that are obviously going to be dropped into strongholds to try and sway people's opinions.
All manner of leaflets. But I guess the classic one was the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
Where we produced millions of these safe conduct passes.
Okay.
That they dropped out of aircraft.
Yeah.
On Iraqi positions. So
saying to you, if you're a soldier and you've got one of those,
yeah,
you're not going to get shot. If you haven't got one of those, you're fair game.
Yeah, pretty much. So that was quite a successful operation. But the course itself, you go through the grounding or the basics of what psychological operations is. You look at the planning process. You look at the target audience analysis. You look at product development and the process you go through to get it approved, the approval process.
It's also, so basically, would you sit round at the table and say, right, we've got this going on in Iraq, we need to get in here, we need to do that. Would you have a sort of like... An aim given to you,
yeah.
Or would you sort of like identify that aim and then work out the...
Well, what you get is the commander's mission. So whatever mission you're going on, whatever operation you're on, you'll have the commander's mission, and he will have a mission that he needs to achieve.
Yeah.
And PsyOps comes in and looks at his mission and looks how they can support his mission with a campaign of informing the target audience.
Yeah.
Of
what it is you want what you want to get across.
Yeah. So basically, psychological operations, all it is directed at a target audience.
Because it's not just leaflets, is it? You have those great big radio packs that you can stick on and all that sort of stuff. Is that within your
remit?
Yeah,
I'll come on to that. But,
oh, good. I'll be joining this.
But basically, it's a target audience to change an attitude and a behaviour.
Okay.
And that's the crux of what psychological...
But that's a difficult thing to do, because these places are hostile. They're a completely different sort of like organisation and belief to ourselves, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? So that's a tall order to go into somewhere like that and persuade them, isn't it?
Absolutely. So it all starts for us operators, because that's why I became an operator, originally on the print section, but later on radio. And I'll come on to the radio stuff, because that's really important stuff that I was doing with that. But when I first got recruited, the squadron leader at the time asked me if I would be prepared to deploy out if the need arose. Yeah, no problem at all, I said. So 6 months after joining the unit, I got mobilised to go to Kosovo. So once I got identified, then what you do, you look into the target audience. You look at the country study, you look at everything you can find out about the target audience that you're trying to influence, that you need to change an attitude or a behaviour in. Now, the main target audience initially was the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. And then when I finally got there, our mission had changed to the Serb population in Kosovo that were being targeted by the ethnic Albanians. So most of my job when I got there was directed at the ethnic Albanians. And while we were there, there was the PsyOps or support element, and then there was Media Ops, and they were two separates.
Yeah.
The Media Ops had a secure fit FFR Land Rover with some secret radio kit in there and a sat phone and mobile phones. And what they used to do is they used to get the journalists, and they would be the liaison between the journalists and the commander on the ground to give them an update on what incident's going on.
So you've got the propaganda, which is what that fairly is, going back to the UK, which is eyes looking in on our side, but you're also trying to put propaganda the other way.
Well, the journalists were out there for whatever was going on, and we had all sorts come out there from like Kate AD and who's the other one? Liam Fox? No. Robert Fox, and a few others from the papers, Christian Jennings from the Telegraph. So the Media Ops officers would have a Media Ops driver on this secure fit Land Rover, and they go out to whatever incident was going on with the liaison. Their driver got compassionate and got flown out. They didn't have anybody else that could drive that secure fit Land Rover. And I got dicked for it. So on top of the work I was doing with PsyOps, then I used to have to get crashed out with the Media Ops officer to go and meet the journalist.
What rank are you now?
I was a corporal then.
Okay, right.
Cool. So I full screw right in. So I'm crashed out, and some of them got to know what I did and the PsyOps side of it. And some of them sort of freaked out, and some of them, like Christian Jennings, got it totally.
Yeah.
One of the worst things I went out to was a couple of the mass graves.
It was unpleasant stuff, wasn't it? They were doing some hideous stuff out there, weren't they?
I mean, that
not that well publicised back home, to be honest. People don't realise the extent of the damage and the carnage that was being seen over there.
So I had to bear witness at some of these mass graves, and it wasn't nice. And that sort of haunts me a little bit to this day.
Yeah.
So that was that tour. And I ended up doing a second tour. I backed onto I did Agricola 2 and Agricola 3. And then I came out in the October when the Marines came in on Agricola 4. The following year, 2001, I was up on JMC, which is the Joint Maritime Course in Faslane.
Yeah.
I thought it was just a support operation. We were when we got there, we found out what it was. It was a massive, massive exercise, and they got sort of two carrier groups, an American one and Illustrious, coming up either side of the country, and all converging on the Hebrides. And we were working in the first week. We were in the Maritime Ops Centre, and I was co-located with the SF cell. And the second week, we were going to go out and work off of HMS Illustrious. So we only had a team of three of us on this. And over the first weekend, we got extracted to go to Kosovo, to go to Macedonia.
Yeah.
So the three of us extracted, left the support to this operation, this exercise. To go to Macedonia. So we drove down over the weekend. Monday morning, me and another guy drove up to Chilwell, got mobilised. Tuesday, we went into main building, got a full brief on what was going on in Macedonia at the time. And then a couple of weeks later, we flew out to Macedonia. Our kit had been put on wagons on the ships at Marchwood. And we went down to Thessalonica, picked the wagons up, brought them up to Skopje. We were part of Task Force Harvest.
Okay.
We were out there 3 weeks before the old Blair Assault Brigade turns up.
Yeah.
And we were down there with our cameras and stuff, getting pictures and imagery of Barney White Spanner and his Blair Assault team coming in to Skopje. And then I did a bit of work with the paras up in some of the villages and that, where they were collecting weapons. And from an operational perspective, it was, for us, it was quite a good operation, because it put us in the limelight. It was a successful operation because we took in more weapons than we set out to do. And
so your part in this, was it leaflets?
No, I was at that time, we didn't do leaflets, but we did newspaper articles.
Okay.
We did radio pieces.
Got you.
RDS radio, you know, your radio with RDS.
Yeah.
Well, you can have a scrolling message in Macedonia. You can't do that here. So one of the messages was NATO, the mission continues. And they put that out, and that was a first on RDS radios. So it was deemed a success from that point of view. Off the back of that, then we got a lot more funding and some new equipment identified. During that, 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
5 months later, I'm flying into Kabul thinking, what have I done to myself this time?
What rank are you now?
I was still a corporal at
okay.
that time. I didn't pick my sergeant up until I came back.
Okay.
So I did 5 months in Kabul. And predominantly, my role was putting together the ISAF news. We came up with this concept of what we called the ISAF news, which is a tri-language newspaper directed at the local population. So it was in English, Pashto and Dari.
Yeah.
And that was another nightmare. We told them that we used to work with Adobe Creative Suite, and we said that we needed the Middle East version of it. So they give us a standard.
So your translations are all right and all that sort of stuff?
Well, no, the Middle East gives you the opportunity to work in Arabic script.
So, okay, yeah. That's what I'm saying. All the writing's correct. Because it doesn't take much. It's all punctuated. It's all in the punctuation, the Arabic text, isn't it? So if you get it wrong, it can completely mean something else.
And to add complications into it, then you've got Pashto fonts, which are quite a lot different, and there's quite a few more fonts than the Arabic ones. So rather than give us what we needed to do the job with, we had the basic version, which didn't work. From that, what we had to do, we got an old Windows laptop, bastardised it and put Arabic Windows onto it, so the interpreters could write out the Pashto and the Dari script, print it out onto bits of paper. We had to cut it out, then we had to paste it up onto a big sheet. A nightmare. Absolute bloody nightmare.
So you must photocopy in that in order to get it rolled out on a proper print run?
Yeah.
That's insane, isn't it?
Yeah.
For the sake of somebody going, I'll tell you what, they actually need that. But in the scheme of things, that program's not going to cost a lot of money either, is it? Do you know what I mean?
£745. I know, because I got someone to buy it for us.
Yeah.
And send it out. So we got that loaded on and made the whole process so much easier. Yeah. Because they sent out some new kit. So that was, for me, it was a really, really good tour. I managed to get out. I used to go out on the ground quite a bit, just me and one of the interpreters.
Who were you going out with?
Just me.
Okay.
Just me on the ground with an interpreter, only in the local area.
Civvies type?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
No, I was in uniform, carrying the weapons and everything, so... It was a benign area at that time.
Yeah. Oh, right, okay.
I mean, if we had to go up to Bagram, then we had to get the Italian escort. But just for going into the local area, I could go out. And we had the radio television Afghan across the road. We had the American embassy.
Whereabouts were you?
In the university building.
Okay, yeah, I know that.
The main headquarters.
Yeah, got you. Yeah, I know where that is, yeah.
So we could go into the local area. And I got to do some interviews. I did Ashraf Ghani, I did Hamid Karzai, I did the Minister of the Heart.
Karzai's really well spoken, isn't he? I've met Karzai myself. He's really well spoken.
So I got them interviewed for the newspaper, the ISAF News. I also, they had the big lawyer Jerger on there.
That's right. I was there when that was going on.
And there was a woman from Helmand province.
Yeah.
I didn't know this at the time, but Fazia, her name was. And she was able to speak at this, and she was quite well respected. And I managed to get an interview with her. Then we handed over on the 20th of June to the Turks. And the Turks took over from us. They got a whole brand new kit and everything like that. And we left a load of our stuff there for them to use. That was quite fun. The Germans down at warehouse camp, they had a small PSYOPs unit there, invited the other PSYOPs units in Kabul down for a barbecue on this Sunday before we flew out, and invited the Turks. The Turks went fairly hungry, actually. Fortunately, there was some salad. Germans aren't culturally...
No, it would have been pig, 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 pig and more pig, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was funny. But the Turks did take it in good spirit.
Yeah, cool.
So we came out on the 20th of June, and I went back onto the group after getting demobbed. And I was working on... I was there pretty much all the time on man training days. Then... I got mobilised then to go to Iraq.
Okay.
So I did an Iraq tour in 2003.
Similar sort of thing? Newspapers or...?
Yeah, no, I had a different role. We had a campaign project where we had to come up with a campaign to enhance the perception of the Iraqi police service in the eyes of the locals.
Okay. Yeah.
Can hide into nowhere with that
I
one.
I bet, yeah.
To that end, we had to go out and visit lots of police stations, lots of police chiefs, and get a feeling for how they felt and all the rest of it.
So working in the red zone predominantly?
We were down in, we were actually based out of the APOD.
Okay.
We used to go into Basra, but I used to go up to Assamwa.
We
had a little campaign going with the Dutch up there because the Japanese came in. The Japanese, first time they sent the Japanese military outside of Japan since the Second World War.
Incredible. So I had a friend of mine working with the Japanese, and they couldn't even drive their vans because their vehicles were being put on low loaders and taken around the country. It was insane, wasn't it? Incredible to see the Japanese out there.
But we helped the Dutch come up with a campaign to let the locals know what the Japanese were doing there. It was a Japanese engineering unit that were there specifically to, I think it was rebuild a hotel, a hospital and a school.
Yeah, there was no combat role for the
Japanese. No combat role. They didn't even have weapons, but they were escorted everywhere with the Dutch.
Yeah.
Also did a lot of work with the, and to get to Asama, it was a 7-hour drive from Basra up to Asama. And halfway up was Nazaria, where the Italians were.
Yeah.
So we always used to work it where we'd go up to the Dutch, do the work there, come back to the Italians, spend the night with the Italians.
Yeah, you get a decent scoff, isn't it?
Decent scoff.
I know what you're doing, mate. Yeah,
and a drop
there.
Of wine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and spend the next day doing some work with the Italians. Probably spend another night there before going back to Basra.
Yeah.
The only really dodgy time I had out there was we flew into Alamara.
Okay.
And I was out on patrol in Al Kabir. That's the village the little town that the 6 military police were killed.
Yeah.
That was a horrible feeling. You just sensed that it was horrible.
It was going to go wrong.
And yeah,
was that before or after that incident?
That was after.
Okay.
Yeah, so... we were in that village and we feared for our lives in that. And that was the one and only time I went up there. 3/4 of the way through that tour, 4 months into the tour, my wife at the time was diagnosed with cancer. So Friday afternoon, I gets a call to go and see the padre, which I thought was bloody odd. So I went to see the padre. He broke the news to me. 24 hours later, I'm at home. Worst weekend of my entire life. Monday morning, we went to the Wooden Spoon unit at Stoke Mandeville, and she started her treatment.
Chemo type stuff, yeah?
Chemo, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, cut a long story short, she got clear of it, and they said, if you're clear for 2 years... you'd be okay. Year and 11 months later, came back far more aggressively, and she didn't make it. So that was on the 10th of November 2006.
Well, that's hard.
That was really tough. Yeah. What made it even tougher, the year before, on the 11th of November 2005, my best mate took his life.
Oof.
And... yeah, that shook me to the core.
I bet, yeah. No.
So, moving on then. 4 years later, I got together with my best mate's wife. We'd known each other for, I don't know, 25, 30 years. And we've been married now for just coming up to 14 years.
Wow.
So, you know, they were best mates, her and my wife and me and my mate, so... yeah, and we're having a pretty good life.
Good. No, I'm genuinely happy because it's been something that's been born out of an absolute tragedy, isn't it, really?
Oh, so, Christ, yeah. I mean, yeah. That was a real, real miserable time.
Yeah.
Then in 2006, 2007, I went back to Afghanistan.
Okay.
On my second tour to Helmand. And my main role was radio. And what we were doing, we were producing radio stuff for local radio stations. There was a couple of local radio stations in Lashkar Gah that we used to give them discs to play our messages on.
And they were quite happy with that, weren't they? That's all like...
well, we were paying them.
There you go, yeah. So, money talks. Can you tell me what you were paying, how much you were paying them?
I don't know. It wasn't my department.
Right, okay.
But they were paying them.
It was Benjamin Franklin. It was $100 bills.
$100 bills to play our music or our messages.
Yeah.
Didn't particularly work that well. But we came up with this concept of the Afghan archers. So it's a bit like the archers.
That just cracks me. Yeah. So, just because I can see the hut that they live in, like, do you know what I mean?
So we came up with this concept of the Afghan archers. We put a few scripts together, and it's quite funny. Just going back to Kabul again.
Yeah.
Some of the scripts that we were putting together found it didn't translate particularly well for the newspaper. So what we did, we got the interpreters to write it and then transfer it back into English.
Yeah.
So when you read it, it you kind of got the gist of it, but it didn't make grammatical sense.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But in Pashto and Dari, it did.
It was perfect, yeah.
So the first time we put the script up to the approval process, I got a phone call saying, go and see the political officer and the legal officer, there's a problem. So I went to see them, and they said, what's this? This doesn't make any sense. And I said, explain exactly what's going on. Right, you need to go and see the commander. The commander at the time was General John McCall. I served under him in the poachers.
Right, okay. So, what rank was he then when you served under him?
He was a colonel.
Oh, there you go. So
anyway, cut long story short, explain it to him, no problem at all, blah, 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 signed it all off. Anything that's just news, just go ahead with. Anything that's influence, just run it past us. That was great. Anyway, same thinking in Helmand, in Lashkar. I had one of the Terps that was actually a script writer. So I got him to write the scripts, transfer it into English, same problem. Went to city commander, sorted out. No issues whatsoever.
What was the basic script for this Archers then?
Well, we had different storylines. So we had different, guys going into the market.
Man buys goat.
Talking about, one of the incidents was that there was a bomb blast
in
one of the markets, and it was talking about who was responsible for it.
So the Archers would be sort of like pro the forces.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was all about...
I want to get an episode. Have you still got an episode?
I have somewhere.
We'll have to get you in again.
But it's in Pashto.
It doesn't matter. We'll transfer it the other way and we'll read an episode of The Archers in Afghan. That's hilarious. Yeah. That's comedy gold for me.
So just down the road from the camp in Lashkar was the Women's Centre. And one of our female interpreters, she was a Navy girl, was working down there and said that the women down there would like to put an episode together. Turns out that this woman I had, Fazia, that I interviewed in Kabul in 2002, was working at the Women's Centre. So we met up again and had a really good chat. They came up with a whole episode, in fact, two episodes. And they brought a sewing machine in and all sorts. I mean, the little operation to get him into this room where we were doing recording was quite funny. But they came in and I managed to disguise their voices once we recorded it.
Yeah.
First one took 4 hours.
Wow.
Just sat around talking. And then when we hit the go button, the whole script in 10 minutes. Bump. Didn't need any editing as such, only to disguise the voices slightly.
I can imagine it was quite good fun.
Oh, fantastic fun.
It's just one of those things. What did you call it? What was it called? It wasn't called the Archers. What was it called?
It was called the Afghan Archers.
Is that what it
was? Called it the Afghan Archers.
Genius. Did it work? Did the campaign work?
It did, yeah. It produced some good results. We got some feedback from it.
Okay.
Then I came back out of that tour and we started to bring out the concept of radio in a box.
Okay.
So the radio in a box is essentially a commercial radio station in a box. So it's got a 50-watt radio FM transmitter with a media case, and you hook up a laptop to it and a microphone. And you push out music or
you can boom
messages.
It out, and everybody can get hold of it if they want to get hold of it. And it, the very nature of the sort of people they are, but they do listen to it and all.
And we were dumping these wind-up radios and everything, gizzets, loads of gizzets. We spent millions on gizzets for the guys on the ground. So I came back out of that, and we'd been developing the radio in the box concept for quite a while. Then I went back in 2008, and my main role then was to roll out the radio in the box. So a few had been scattered around.
What rank are you now?
I was a sergeant.
Okay,
you're sergeant. No, I wasn't. I was a colour sergeant.
Okay, cool.
I picked up colour sergeant by then.
Yeah.
I was a sergeant on the last tour. So I was a colour sergeant.
Because this is like, when you look at this now and understanding what I do, this is a strategic asset. This is a proper, this is a game changer, isn't it?
It's not. Absolutely.
You know, this is not, this is like proper, it's up there with SF type operations, isn't it? It's a proper, yeah. This is game changing stuff.
So when I went out, there'd been a couple of these radios put into different areas that wasn't working quite well. So my whole 6 months was bouncing around the whole of Helmand, delivering out and delivering training interpreters to be radio presenters, training the guys that were looking after the interpreters to be radio producers, and showing them how the equipment works, how to maintain the equipment, and to set them up in the first place. It's not as easy as you think.
No, because having set up a radio station with Johnny over there, he's now he's now nodding in agreement and justifying his place over there.
So you've got a coax, you've got to feed up onto the roof, you've got the antenna to put together, and depending on what frequency you're using, you have to set the antenna to the right length, else you don't get a very good signal.
That's well above my pay grade, that I'm telling you now. Do you know what I mean? That's like, I anything propagation-wise, antennas and that, forget about it.
Yeah,
that ain't me.
Because of the dust situation there as well, I mean, they need regular taking apart, blowing out and putting back together, and make sure you don't cock it up. So that was what I was doing. So I had some major, major successes. The first major success I had, I installed one down in Garmacia in the south of the area. Now, the guys had been pushing out, there was rural Welsh in there at the time. They'd pushed out about 10 k's south of the district centre in Garmacia. So I went there, installed this radio, got it tuned in and everything. Been working with a couple of interpreters to be presenters, and the guys that were running them for about a week to get them sorted. We were going to do a test one afternoon before going live the following day, just to make sure it worked. So I had a few guys out with these wind-up radios and a couple of guys down at the patrol bases further south. We'd only been on the air for half an hour before we switched it off. A little while later, two guys approached the camp holding up bits of paper. There was a little bit of concern over that. Turns out that these two guys had heard the radio broadcast and wanted a tune playing for them and their mates.
You couldn't, doing requests at the camp.
You couldn't make this stuff up. So the following morning, the guys went live at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they went 6 till 9, and then we're going to do an afternoon show from 3 till 6.
Hey, there's scope there to sell some merchandise, you know that. Start doing merch and that.
So we they'd only been on the what's name for a couple of hours, and there was guys walking up with bits of paper, wanting request playing for them and the mates.
Wow.
So we started incorporating that in. So we were putting in some local news. We were putting in our messages, mind awareness stuff and different bits and pieces, and reporting crime and any sort of Taliban activity.
Yeah.
And this was all starting to work really well. Been going for a couple of days, and it's only blokes that are coming up with bits of paper. I said to the boys, what if we put in a couple of girls' names saying that they've asked their brother in to bring a message in for them and their girlfriends? So that next transmission, they put out about 3 different requests from girls. They made up girls' names, Afghan girls' names. Lo and behold, that afternoon, There's a stampede. A stampede almost of requests for girls and their girlfriends to have tunes played for them.
Wow.
That is a measure of effect.
Yeah, gold.
By the end of that week, I was due to fly back via Lash to pick up another set and fly then. I think I went up to Kajaki after that. But I took a stack of about 2,000 of these bits of paper back to Lash. And at that evening's prayers, I had to go into the ops, into the CO's brief.
Yeah.
And just explain what had happened. And got a big pat on the back for that. Following morning, I flew out then to Kajaki.
Yeah.
Did a similar sort of thing there. There was a radio already there, but it was up at the south end of the ridge. It wasn't even hooked up, and they was using it as a table. So I've hauled this thing all the way from that one back to, I think it was Athens, which is the one at the top of the, what's name, and set it up with the EW boys.
Yeah.
Just to broadcast our messages, and they would pick them up off the net. So I was there for a couple of weeks. I had a fantastic week, couple of weeks there. I flew in on the aircraft that Ross Kemp flew out on.
Oh, okay.
So, all right, Ross. And then I ended up down in Sangin. Did quite a lot of work in Sangin. We had a 4-kilowatt transmitter down there.
You were going to punchy places with this.
Of course, all those places
you just said, Kajaki, Sangin, you know, they were all proper punchy places, weren't they? They certainly had their problems, didn't they?
Yeah. I went into FOB Gibraltar, I think it was. It was one just south of Sangin. And I was there for about a week and a bit. And the guy that was running the team down there was an old mate of mine. I used to go skiing with. I'm a telemark skier.
Yeah.
And I competed at the Army and one thing or another. I worked with him and his guys. And the afternoon, the last afternoon, I was going to go out and patrol with them. But I had a message saying that a helicopter's coming to take me out. I got onto a helicopter, flew out. A couple of days later, I found out that him and his guys had been killed in a bomb blast.
Mm.
That's another thing that really rocked me.
Yeah.
It's devastating. I mean, we were really good mates. And that, I don't know what happened with the radio down there after that, because him and his two Turks were killed.
So how many tours did you end up doing all told?
I did 7 operational tours in PSYOPs.
Okay.
Tell
us quickly, so what did you sort of like finish up as? Where did you end up going after you'd done your last tour?
I finished in 2009.
Okay.
And when I got back to the group, I had a choice. I could do one of a couple of things. They didn't have another FTRS post to give me at the time. Okay. But they said that they could get me promoted to WO2. Or I could look for another FTRS job. I was offered a job up at I Branch as an instructor in the interrogation branch. Didn't really fancy that. I was offered another job of being a counter-terrorist briefer. And that meant travelling all the time around the country to different units, briefing on counter-terrorism.
Yeah.
And this other job came up as a unit welfare officer for London Central Garrison. That sounds interesting. So I went down and had an interview, and I was originally pinned to be the welfare officer for F Company Scots Guards.
Yeah.
But I started on the 1st of September 2009. I actually got posted to Woolwich, and with Nijmegen Company Grenadier Guards. Day 2 in the job, the Sergeant Major says, day 1, just sort myself out. Day 2 in the job, boys are going out for a run up to Shooter's Hill in the morning. Did I want to go with them? Thought, I mean, I'm 53 at the time. I'm thinking, I'm going to be struggling against these young lads. Total opposite. We're only half mile in, and I'm already sort of dragging the laggers behind forward. And yeah. Starts gobbing off, and I'm gobbing off all the way up the Shooter's Hill. We got them to the top of Shooter's Hill, and I said, lads, look, you're infantry soldiers. If you can't keep up with a 53-year-old, you need to take a long, hard look at yourself.
So what cap badge were you wearing then?
Oh, Royal Anglian.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, I rebadged. That's another little story. I went on the deck commander's course at Blandford.
Yeah.
Because when I transferred across, I was still signals cap badged. At the end of the course, the end of course washout, there was a female WO2 taking the debrief. And she said, why am I there? I'm not in a signals unit. I'm taking up a place for a signals person. I took real umbrage at that. Went back to the group. One of my bosses was a Royal Anglian. I said, look, I was born a Royal Anglian. I want to go back. He said, I'll have a word with Regimental Headquarters. Regimental Headquarters was a colonel, the secretary of the Royal Anglian Regiment, was one of my old bosses. He said, no problem at all. Rebadged a couple of weeks later, back to Royal Anglian.
Okay.
You can stuff the signals.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's no attitude to take at all.
No, of course not. So when did you actually finish in the military?
I finished on the 4th of April 2018.
Okay.
Having spent 8 years as a unit welfare officer in London Central Garrison.
Okay. I'm gonna force us into your retirement now. What, not your retirement from the army, your retirement, but what do you do now?
Well, off the back of some of the stuff I was doing in as a welfare officer, we got into lockdown, and I started a podcast.
Okay.
And I did 24 half an hour episodes of my life. So if there's any listeners out there suffering from insomnia, they can have a listen to that and put them straight to sleep. Then I did a couple of extra episodes of in-depth stuff that I'd done.
Yeah.
And I thought, what do I do next? Why don't I do other people's lives? So I started telling other people's, or getting other people to tell their life history.
Okay, what's your podcast called?
It's you can find it on the Tim Hill podcast or Ordinary People's Extraordinary Stories.
Okay.
And there's 300 odd on there at the moment. There's a basic format to that. I ask people when and where they were born. I ask them to describe what it was like where they grew up, the schools they went to, the education they got. Then we pull that to bits, and then we look at their work life history, and then we look where they are nowadays. The idea is to leave a legacy for future generations so they can look back at this time in history to see what ordinary people did with their lives. Yeah. Then I have a live show. I do a live show every Thursday or most Thursdays. If I'm not doing a live one, it's a pre-recorded one. And it's called Everyday Conversations Regarding Mental Health. And I get people on to talk about different aspects of mental health. And there isn't a subject we won't cover.
Okay.
We've looked at death, suicide, abuse, drug addiction.
Alcohol.
All sorts of stuff we talk about. We've talked about the menopause and how it affects the males.
Yeah.
Because the female menopause just doesn't affect women. Trust me,
I know where you're coming from with that, yeah.
And we looked at it from the female perspective as well, what they go through. So it's, it's a really good show. Anybody that wants to listen in to mental health
issues. We'll stick it all below. So it'll all be in the links and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And when we do our social media, we'll obviously give you a massive chuck there as well. So
yeah, thanks.
Yeah, we'll get that out there. Just people want us. What are your plans for the future, quickly?
Well, what I'm trying to do, I mean, I joined this thing called Podmatch.
Yeah.
It's based in America, and that's where I've got most of my guests from for Ordinary Stories and for the for the Everyday Conversations. What I'd like to do is to get more UK-based guys on and girls to talk about their mental health.
Yeah.
I think that's important. I think
massively important. What, I think mental health is something that needs talking about and needs a platform as well. So.
Yeah. What we're trying to do is take the stigma out of it.
Yeah.
To make it okay to talk about.
Absolutely where I'm at. That's proper in line with what we're about too. So
yeah.
You know, anything we can do to help you with that, we obviously will.
So that's where we are. But in London I had so many opportunities to take the piss.
Yeah.
I mean the Queen's birthday parade. We managed to wrangle our wells way into, you know, when the Queen sits out the front and the General's office, you've got all the minor royals up there. Well, I'm in the bell tower stopping people getting to the minor royals. So we've got all the minor royals up there. That was good fun. You've seen the Festival of Remembrance.
Yeah.
Where Big Vern stands at the top of the steps and the curtains open and people run down. I'm on a curtain. I'm in full blues, like.
You're getting yourself everywhere, then.
Yeah, I did all the guards. I did Buckingham Palace, St James's Palace, Tower of London, and Windsor Guard.
Tower's good. I'm impressed by the tower. Yeah.
Well, I used to go because the boys were on stag and all the rest of it. So I used to go down there, and then I did a couple of senior sergeants standing in when we were really strapped because we were still heavily involved in Afghan in that time.
Yeah.
I also did a visiting officer, a notification officer a couple of times. So I had real golden opportunities. I used to take guys sailing. I used to get part of the role that I made it because it was a blank piece of paper when I started. I wove in there adventurous training. So being a big sailor, I used to take guys sailing. Being a big skier, I used to get guys to the British Telemark Championships.
Nice.
Run by the Army. I was on the first Army team to take on the Navy in the memoir, and we won.
Nice. That's what we like to hear. That's what we want.
And I was 2 seconds off being picked to go on the Army team for the tri-services.
Wow. You've done a little bit there.
Yeah.
Superb. Listen, I'm going to have to draw us to an end because we are well and truly. It's probably the longest one I've done, isn't it, Johnny? It's probably the longest podcast I've done.
One can only apologise.
No, you don't need to apologise. But what I think we need to do at some stage is have you back, and we'll do the archers because I really want this. If you can dig a script out. I want to do the archers on here and just talk through it a little bit more because I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Look, I hope you'll become a friend of the show. If we can help you promote your stuff, of course we will. Stay in touch with the team. Stay in touch with me. It's been a pleasure having you.
Oh, I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good to see you, bud. All right. Nice one.